Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, 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 it's Monday, and it is time for What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and this is the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Today, I'm really pleased to announce that I have a wonderful guest, Lydia Tanaglia, who has been is one of the founding producers for 0.0 Productions. This is an Emmy and Peabody Award-winning television and digital production company that was founded by Lydia and her co-executive producer, Chris Collins. And I know them from way back when I was doing publicity for books. And I did the publicity for A Cook's Tour by Anthony Bourdain, and Lydia and her crew did the filming of that show. And they have gone on to shoot and produce unbelievable and wonderful films and documentaries and Emmy Award-winning series, like Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown, which is on CNN, The Mind of a Chef, which is on Netflix. And in 2013, they acquired the Food Republic website, one of the launch properties, in a new ZPZ-owned publishing venture. And they are currently in production on Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown Season 5.
Six.
Oh, is it six? Oh, well, you guys have to update your website then, girl.
I know, we do have to update our website.
I will go on, and thank you for that correction. An untitled series with Christiane Amanpour. Now, that's ongoing, right? That hasn't aired yet.
Yes, we are actually in production on that with CNN. It's a new project with Christiane.
And you guys are doing a series on Detroit, Once a Great City.
Yes, that's based on a book by David Moranis, by the same name, Once in a Great City, and it really focuses on Detroit during a very specific period of its history, which is around 1962 to 64. So it's a very concentrated look at Detroit when it was really at its height as a great American city. It was sort of held up as an example of how a city could really be firing on all cylinders and functioning properly. And it was almost sort of this bubble of Detroit's history that was a kind of perfect example of how things could go right, you know.
Wow. And then this summer, and I'm sure you saw this too, but there was a National Public Radio produced a series about the riots in Detroit, which were a few years after that, I guess.
Yes. There seems to be a lot of focus on that particular period of Detroit's history. The film, Catherine Bigelow's film, just released.
Right.
That really focuses on that time period. This time period is, you know, nearly 7-8 years before that, and sort of focuses on that golden period of Detroit's history.
Isn't that fascinating, Lydia? That first of all, that so many creative minds are converging at once on this particular decade in the history of Detroit, but also that in that period of time, you show off the golden age, and just a few short years later, the city was in a shambles.
Yeah,
and has yet to recover. And I think it's sort of in recovery now, because I think more people are moving out there because housing stock is cheap, right?
Yes. I mean, I think it is in recovery. I mean, we've certainly shot in Detroit, you know, on the Bourdain series, and you can really see, you know, a renaissance happening in that city, which is really amazing. You know, I think, the period that we're concentrating on is really sort of showing, you know, how the, you know, between the car industry and Motown and sort of the civic leaders at that time, politics of the city, you know, were intersecting in all the right ways. In that exploration, you definitely get a sense of, you know, the underpinnings, you know, that would eventually lead to the city kind of cracking apart. But it's a really fascinating story about this particular it's almost 18-month period, two-year period, where the city was just completely firing on all cylinders in the right way. And I think it's going to be a really fascinating look, and one that has so much relevance to, I think, what's happening now.
Absolutely.
You know, as well. So
yeah.
That's also on CNN, and that will be out in 2018, like mid-year 2018.
Uh-huh. And then you have four documentary feature films, including Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent. And that, I want to tell you that my friend Martha called me up about a week ago. Actually, she texted me at like 9 o'clock at night. She said, I just finished watching this amazing documentary about Jeremiah Tower. Have you seen it? And I said, no, I have not seen it. I immediately watched it and it was fabulous.
Oh,
totally great.
You.
Totally recommend it. But today we're going to talk about Waste, the story of food waste, which is going to debut in October of this year. So tell us a little bit about Wasted and who is in it and why you focused on, because it's got a lot of star chefs in it, and what they, you know, what they offer in terms of solutions for this tremendous problem that we face as a nation.
Yeah, I mean, the documentary came about through a collaboration with the Rockefeller Foundation, who, you know, in 2013, initiated a new endeavor called YieldWise. They launched this program called YieldWise, which is like a $130 million initiative to reduce food waste by 50% by the year 2030. So it's one of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, and Rockefeller is, you know, heavily involved in that. And so we, you know, really, frankly, as people who've been working in food, travel television for almost 17 years, you know, you go around the world and you see firsthand the way different countries approach their food. I mean, countries that are, you know, less bountiful and fortunate as the United States, the way that they go about, you know, their connection with food. We're very connected to that, and we've seen it firsthand. And so we actually developed a pitch for a film idea to take to Rockefeller.
Uh-huh.
That's how the collaboration started. I think Rockefeller hasn't done films like this in the past, and I think they were very interested in our angle in, which is really through the eyes of chefs. People obviously enjoy watching food. They watch food television. And we thought, how do you make a really challenging subject like this, you know, because these advocacy films and, you know, these cause-driven films sometimes, you know, turn people off or are hard to market. We figured, let us go in through the eyes of chefs and you know, look at the ways that they're offering solutions to this problem. So that's what we did. We wanted to make it entertaining. We wanted to make it beautiful to watch, and we wanted to make it very solution-driven, but in a way that was accessible to people. So chefs were really the way to do that. So we focused primarily on, you know, Dan Barber, who's sort of obsessed to the nose-to-tail approach to a farm.
You know,
obviously, we hear a lot about nose-to-tail eating in general, but he said, you know, people do it with animals, nose to tail eating with animals. Why don't we do that with a farm? So he's constantly, obsessively looking at farms and vegetables, what's producing there, the biomass of like certain plants, and you know, the idea of using what we consider waste, you know, for flavor. And Dan is really a trailblazer in that regard.
Sure.
Vitaly, too, you know, he's a trailblazer in that he made Offal, you know, very popular. And so we focused a scene on him and one of his chefs at ESCA looking at trash fish, you know, fish that people basically throw away when they do they're sort of the bio-catch, like the trash fish that you throw away when you're catching the fish.
Yeah, bycatch.
Bycatch.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they did a dish with that. And Danny Bowen, somewhat enamored with peasant cuisine, sort of a real student of culinary traditions. And so, you know, his focus on, again, using, you know, produce, vegetables that are typically overlooked, you know, in his meals. And then Massimo Pottura, of course, you know, he's taking his celebrity and sort of leveraging it for the greater good with his raffinatorio concept, which is really sort of a, for lack of a better description, a really sort of amazingly constructed, beautiful approach to the soup kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And that's really sort of taken off. You know, he's feeding not just people, but revitalizing neighborhoods and getting communities involved in this. What started out in Milan, Italy, and now he has different branches of the raffinatorio elsewhere. He's opening one in France. There's one in Brazil. And he's going to really push forward to try to open more raffinatorios around the world.
So just to dwell on that concept for a second. So a raffinatorio would be a place where leftovers or waste from, I don't know, farms or households is recycled into food and then fed to the poor. Is that what you're talking about?
That is exactly okay. But the building itself is beautifully constructed. It tables are set out. There's plates and silverware and glasses and yes, they procure waste from various supermarkets and restaurants. And by waste, it means, you know, that leftover produce that's
right.
perfectly usable, perfectly, still vital.
Sure.
And they take that material and they repurpose it for this raffinatorio, this kitchen that feeds people in the neighborhood.
Wow, that's an amazing story.
Yeah.
So just to sort of back up for a second, let's talk a little bit about what the economic and ecological impacts of food waste are, because most of my listeners are pretty tuned into this topic, but just to recap for those who might be new to it, in the United States alone, we waste about 40% of the food that we grow, right? What is the economic impact of that? What does that cost, roughly?
1.3 billion tons of food wasted every year.
Unbelievable.
So the annual cost of food waste is about $1 trillion.
Mm.
You know, when you look globally, there's 800 million people or so starving globally in the world. So in the U.S., we do waste 40% of the food that is produced.
Yeah.
It's thrown away. 90% of that wasted food typically ends up in landfills. And, you know, people have this tremendous misconception, as did I, going into this project, that, you know, you throw away organic matter, it's just decomposing, and that's what it does. But when food rots in a landfill, it actually produces methane, which is 23 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas, you know, than carbon dioxide. So it is one of the single most egregious producers. Rotting food in landfills is one of the biggest egregious, you know, producers of greenhouse gases.
Why does that happen in landfills and not in compost?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I think, you know, years ago, we didn't have recycling bins, right?
Yeah.
And suddenly people put recycling bins out and people started to concertedly recycle. Composting, I hope, as the film makes its case and the word gets out, is really going to be the new recycling bin. The film made me personally make a change in my life. I thought, I live in New York City. How am I, you know, there's no compost mechanism in the apartment building where I live. You know, how am I going to do this? And with very little research, I realized I could put my food scraps in a separate bin. It doesn't smell. And every Wednesday, I take it to Union Square. Every Wednesday and Saturday, I take it to Union Square. And there's a big community compost drop-off right there. It's a very easy walk, and many, many neighborhoods have that similar, type of, it typically happens in like a farmer's market.
Right.
And I've been concertedly doing that. And I think hopefully the film will have that kind of impact where you're really delivering these very eye-opening statistics to people and compelling them to make a personal change. It starts with individual change.
Yes.
Composting was you know, a hell of a lot easier than I had imagined, I mean, in New York City. So, you know, our hope is that, again, just by presenting the film and making a very chef vision, you know, chef-driven, you know, type of story, you know, people are going to enjoy watching the film, but also learn the individual ways that they can make an impact as well.
Well, one of the things that you describe in the film is the food waste pyramid. And that was something apparently developed by the EPA. Can you talk about the food waste pyramid? What does that mean?
Yeah, you know, the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, developed a food waste pyramid to help us upcycle waste and keep it out of landfills. We didn't work with the EPA in making the film, but we did look at the food waste pyramid, you know, as a sort of guidepost for our narrative. And basically, the food waste pyramid is, you know, at the top of the pyramid is feed people. So any excess food that is produced, you know, should be directly channeled to feeding people. And I think the film shows the ways that we can do that, you know, through Vitaly using the bycatch, by Baturo creating the raffitorio, by the supermarket in Dorchester, Massachusetts, you know, collecting the, you know, what they call the, you know, less than perfect looking produce, and creating this small supermarket where that produce could be sold and created into food products. So, you know, first and foremost, feed people. Secondly is feed animals.
Yeah.
So, you know, animals like pigs and chickens and, you know, they eat anything. So it's, you know, feed people next. And we did a number of scenes where people are really turning food waste into really interesting sources of animal feed.
Mm-hmm.
So we explore those scenes in the film. So feed people, feed animals, composting next, which we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are scenes that talk about how we can turn the food waste into actual energy product. And then, you know, after you've gone through that whole pyramid, you know, then what's left over is the thing that ends up, you know, in the landfill after you've gone through all these tiers, and hopefully you're reducing at every step of that pyramid.
I'm Michael Harlan Turkell, host of The Food Scene and Modernist Breadcrumbs on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here at Bob's Red Mill to find out from Bob himself why his products taste so good. So what's the secret, Bob?
To make the best whole grain flour, we look back in time. No modern technology can match the old world engineering of a stone mill.
Wow. Bob's Red Mill is using stone mills? How old are we talking here?
Well, the stone mills are practically as old as mankind, and no matter what civilization they uncover, they find two stones that people were rubbing together to make something they could eat, whole wheat flour. But the stones that we use are quarried near Paris, France, in La Ferté, and it's the same stone material from the same quarry that the Romans used to make stone mills all over the Roman Empire, of which you can testify by looking at Pompeii. It's a quartz material. It has a uniqueness about it. It's very hard. It has a certain porosity, and they put the stones together in a unit of 20 pieces and band it so that they use only the best and sharpest parts. It's an ingenious thing, but very old. I mean, thousands of years old. So it's pretty cool.
Those sound like some really special stones. How do they work?
Stones turning either the top or the bottom stone, turning at 100 to 125 revolutions per minute, produce a lovely 3-4 up to 500 pounds, depends on how soft the grain is. The bottom stone is the bedstone, and it's also called the nether stone in the Bible, but it also now turns for some configurations.
Would you say that using stone mills lead to healthier grains?
I know they do. I can watch it. I showed you. You know it as well as I do. The grain goes in the top, goes through the stones, and it comes out. We don't lose anything, and we don't add anything.
Thanks for sharing the story of how Bob's Red Mill is using ancient technology to keep their products on the cutting edge.
Michael, we think that we can make a difference by sticking by the traditional way of stone milling whole grain, and that's what we're doing.
You can learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You know, one of the strategies that you include in the film is the South Korean system for not wasting food. And it kind of reminded me of cap and trade in a weird way. And I wondered if you would describe that, because that's actually a financial incentive to people to not waste food. So mm-hmm. Can you describe that for listeners?
The South Korean?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to just remind myself, the South Korean thing was very, very, very cool, because I think they had great success on starting at, like, just the household level,
right,
in a very short period of time. And so in, like, around 2013, like, the South Korean government started tracking the amount of food waste that just one household and slash apartment in South Korea was generating. And they introduced this system where residents were issued an electronic ID card that would open an automated bin and enable them to weigh the food waste being dropped off, and then they would be charged,
wow,
you know, in a certain amount of money,
yep,
for the weight of that food.
Wow.
And so it's like an electric bill. You know, a fee is charged at the end of the month based on how much food a given household is thrown away. And, you know, there's nothing like bills and economics, you know, to motivate people
but, I mean,
to
how did they
reduce their food waste.
Yeah.
And in a very, very short period of time, you know, the people in Seoul were able to change their behavior very, very quickly. I mean, it's, you know, South Korea is a very small country.
Yeah.
They were having a tremendous problem with you know, the discard of their waste.
Really?
And so they introduced this system. You know, people, and you see it in the film, like, people are sitting there kind of squeezing their, you know, food waste down to, like, the smallest possible ball, because it's going to get weighed, and then they're going to get charged based on the weight of that discard.
But how did they enforce compliance with that? That was what struck me as, like, how do you make people do that? Was there a fine if they didn't use their card or something like that? I mean,
yeah,
how did the government track that?
I don't know the specifics of the enforcement. I do mm-hmm. know that, like, you know, the recycling bins that are put out, to throw away your trash in Korea, you have got to, there are bins out on the street, there are electronic bins,
physically
throw away your trash. You've got to put your card in this bin. It's an electronic bin that opens up, and that's how you do it. So you have nowhere else to put your garbage. That's the enforcement.
I see. I gotcha. And what about farmers? I mean, you know, farmers are obliged because of American consumption patterns, they seem to be obliged to discard any food that is not, you know, visually attractive. And what are they doing? I mean, aside from giving to soup kitchens and stuff like that, what are the strategies for farmers? I mean, how do we train Americans to not insist on that blemish-free apple or peach?
It's a great question, and honestly, the farmers can't do that alone. You know,
right.
Supermarkets need to be held accountable, too. I think we show that in the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they, along with the American consumers, you know, both contribute to the obsession to perfect-looking produce. And,
yeah,
you know, you travel in parts of Europe and all over the world, you know, people are not consuming fruits and vegetables that way. I mean,
yeah,
you know, no one needs that perfect looking, you know, red tomato. It's not just the farmers, it's the supermarkets who are obviously, mm-hmm, you know, feeding into the demand and contributing to that obsession. So I think, you know, like we see with, you know, Baturo and many of the people, the characters that we cover, you know, farmers could donate their excess produce to soup kitchens and food banks. You know,
mm-hmm,
their hard work and month-long efforts have, you know, created delicious and healthful food, so it's best at first those calories can be used, as we show in the food pyramid, to feed people. And similarly, their excess could be used to produce and feed animals like pigs and chickens. They can eat anything, so why pay for animal feed when you can feed them the leftovers? So sort of changing that dynamic between, you know, engineered feed to organic feed.
Right.
You know, and I think long-term farmers are starting to work with entrepreneurs to make, you know, new and novel products out of their farm leftovers, like juices. We had done some research where even some farms were working with distillers to create liquor.
Sure. Yep.
You know, the really interesting thing we saw at the General Mills factory where, like, you know, byproduct is used to create energy. So I think once people sort of tap into the actual economics surrounding food waste, I think we're going to see a very concerted change.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, it seems to me that that if the corporate world embraces the concept of reclaiming and reusing food in a variety of different applications, then I think they will see it as a winning strategy for raising their dividends, right? I mean, essentially it all comes down to money. It's the only way anything ever changes, as far as I can tell. It's like
you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It's going to come down to money. When someone realizes, like, holy crap, you know, all that food that's getting thrown away could be generating, you know,
energy.
I've read so many articles now where, you know, entrepreneurs are really starting to tap into that. But I think you're right. Money's going to be the big motivator.
Yeah. One of the things that a lot of the chefs talked about in the film is, you know, changing people's, you know, home cooks becoming more prevalent. And the thing that that I have been talking about for the last 9 years that I've been doing this program is that relatively few people cook at home anymore. And that, to me, you know, it's one of the biggest reasons we have food waste, is that people buy stuff and then they don't quite know what to do with it, or they don't end up using it all. It's one of the reasons why these meal kits have become so popular, because you get your three sprigs of thyme instead of buying a whole bunch that you then throw out because you don't know what to do with it afterwards, you know, like that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But and then a lot of people just don't have access either to cooking facilities, because they live in low-income housing, or maybe their refrigerator isn't working, or they don't have access to a stove. I mean, there are all of these sort of barriers in place for people to go back to the kitchen, not the least of which is lack of education on how to cook. And I wondered if the chefs described any methods in which we could sort of reactivate the impulse towards home cooking that has been lost over the last 25, 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, we don't specifically cover that in the film. I think you cover scenes, with the edible schoolyard, and even in the single mother with her kids in the film, where we do show this re-education that is happening, I think, much to your point, you know, where there are places, even in food deserts, like the Dorchester supermarket, where people are starting to be re-educated, where they can procure, you know, more nutritious and healthful foods. And you know, even places like the Dorchester supermarket have that sort of pre-prepared food section.
Uh-huh.
Trying to answer the question that you just raised, which is a lot of people just don't have the time, the inclination, or the means. So, you know, these sort of pre-prepared meal kits and pre-prepared foods in places like that Dorchester supermarket, you know, I think are helping. But I think, you know, the chefs hopefully in the film do show that, you know, and it is a kind of gradual re-education, that cooking can be fun, you know, even if you're just experimenting with leftovers, you know, and recognizing that food, you know, has value. So that message is sort of reiterated over and over and over again. And people don't think enough about where their food comes from, you know, what it takes to grow one single vegetable or a piece of meat or a slice of bread, in terms of like manpower and water and land and transportation. So I know I'm not answering your question specifically, but I do feel like we are going through sort of waxes and wanes, you know, in our approach to food in the 1950s, you know, TV meals on trays were popular,
Suddenly
there was a big resurgence in the, you know, 70s towards,
scratch cooking, you think?
Yeah, exactly.
Really?
I feel like we're going through cycles, and right now we're in, like, a cross-section of, like, exactly what you described. And I do think there is an overall interest in food, probably more than ever. Like, people are watching food television, you
yes.
see food imagery and Instagram, so there's an obsession with food. But I think, I don't know. It's I don't know what the exact solution is.
Yeah, it's hard to say whether that obsession with food translates into actually getting in the kitchen and cooking on a regular basis. I'm not talking about, I feel like cooking this week, I'm going to go out and spend a bunch of money on, you know, X number of ingredients and wow my friends or whatever and make one really great meal. It's like, you know, it's the day-to-day prep. The day-to-day having a pantry, you know, that kind of stuff that I think eludes a lot of people, partly because of busy schedules, two-parent working, you know, parents, you know, everybody's out of the house. There's nobody there to really do that, which what housewives did back in the day.
I confess personally, I have gotten pretty deep into the food kit.
Really?
I have, and I have found it extremely useful. I mean, I work, I have two kids.
Right. I get
it.
You
know, to be able to have the, sort of that box of, like, just what you need.
Right.
And a recipe, and I've, in all honesty, I feel like we've reduced our personal food waste as a family, you know, considerably, you know, through that approach.
Interesting.
And I, you know, I take all the materials that the box comes in, and I try to put all those materials in the recyclable, so...
Yeah,
you know, cutting down on that, hopefully. I mean, I'm not advocating that that's a solution for everybody, but it's definitely a solution that has worked for us. I feel like our takeout consumption has been reduced by probably 75%.
And wow.
Like, you know, I'm cooking meals for the kids, and they seem to like it, and we have very little leftover. So I don't know. It's a solution that seems to be working for
me. Well, I think it's a really interesting phenomenon. I also think the meal kits are like a gateway to cooking without a meal kit. You know what I mean? Like it,
exactly.
Because it shows people that it's really, cooking is not rocket science. It is really freaking easy.
Yeah.
And
it is. You're
you know,
right.
For being just, right. I mean, you don't have to be Paul Bocuse, you know, you don't have to be Mario Batali. You can make your own spaghetti sauce, for example. As a basic example, you know, instead of buying a sugar laden jar for $3.95, you can buy a can of tomatoes for $1.59 and make just as good, if not better, a sauce with a couple of, you know, with basically salt, pepper, and garlic, you know?
Yeah, absolutely right.
You know, it's somehow, on some level, I feel like cooking television robbed people of the idea that cooking is as easy as it is because what they show is usually so, you know, has such a wow factor to it.
Right.
We digress somewhat, but we have a couple of minutes. One thing that I wanted to bring up with you, because Massimo Bottura, in talking about the raffiat, how do you say that word? Raffittorio?
Yeah, raffittorio. Yeah.
Okay. I was surprised that you guys didn't include the Wii food model, which the Danish have pioneered. Have you seen that? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, we are familiar with it, and I believe we did do research into that. I mean, uh-huh. Budget-wise, schedule-wise,
right,
we did try to cover places all over the world. We went to Japan, went to Korea, Italy. You know, we went to several different countries. So I think schedule-wise, we weren't able to cover everything. I mean, personally and secretly, I'm hoping that, you know, we can pitch this idea of food waste as a series and continue to explore it. But
that's a great idea, Lydia. I hope that works out for you.
Anyone listening out there, that's our next pitch.
Think about it. Think about it.
You know, there's so much to cover in this idea.
This arena, right. I actually know the woman who developed the Wii food model. I mean, through a friend who works at the UN, I met this woman. And
I mean, we did cover Daily Table, which is the supermarket I referenced earlier in Dorchester, Massachusetts. And they seem to be adopting a similar, you know, concept to We Food.
Well, We Food, just to tell listeners who may not know, it's basically the surplus from any supermarket in Denmark is then transferred to another store where it is discounted 30% to 50%. And that's just an effort. It's like food that whose label is, you know, their expiration label is coming up tomorrow, or, you know, produce that might be just a little bit shop worn or whatever. It goes into the We Food market and it's heavily discounted and therefore much more accessible to a larger group of people, and including people who are, it's not necessarily geared towards a low income population. It's for anybody who cares about food waste and wants to reduce it.
Exactly. I mean, we did cover that scene. Daily Table in the Dorchester, Mass. Is exactly that model. It's very similar. They do exactly the same thing. And you see the demographic of people who are going in there. Daily Table was specifically set up in an area that was considered a food desert. You know, food deserts are places where people don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, or getting, you know, the bulk of their groceries, like in corner bodegas and things like that. So this was set up in a food desert, but the demographic that went through there are not just low income people, but, you know, whole cross-section of
middle-class people, so, you and me. Yep. I mean, yep. I would shop at a place like that if it existed in my neighborhood. Yep. Absolutely, no question. Because we do have to wrap up actually pretty soon, what kind of political will do you see existing in this country for making changes at the federal? Like the We Food thing was promoted by the Danish Minister of Food and the Environment. The French have banned supermarkets from throwing food away entirely. Do we have anything like that kind of momentum or movement within our government agencies or within our congressional representatives where food waste is kind of a big deal? You guys didn't interview any politicians, did you?
We didn't interview any politicians. And, you know, when we were in the midst of production of the film, we were definitely in a different political climate than we are now.
Indeed, we were.
Now, so I'm taking a big, you know, anxious breath,
yeah.
Because it's hard to say politically and governmentally and congressionally, you know, where any of the action is. So we, I think, purposely, you know, chose to target in the film consumers and everyday people, because the change is really going to have to start at that level. I mean, people eat three times a day, three times a day that they can think about where they buy and cook and eat, you know, three times a day where they can be conscious of what they're consuming and what they're throwing out. So, you know, the film is very targeted on the consumer level, the people level. You know, once that knowledge is really transferred, then hopefully there are no barriers, you know, to change, and people will start to ask for that. I mean, again, just talking on my own personal level, I made a change after we were working on the film. Like, I started throwing my stuff in a separate bin to take to the compost, walk that 15 minutes to the Union Square Market, and dump it in the common, you know, composting bin there.
Yeah.
Personal change that I made, and I think
that's something we can all do. And in New York, my building now has a composting. You know, we have a recycle. We have a food waste bin in our basement now.
Like, we're supposed to. You
do? Yes.
Really? And that's amazing.
That's a program. No, but that's a program that Bloomberg started like 3-4 years ago, before de Blasio. And it's been going by, you know, sort of, what do you call it, district by district, through the city and through the boroughs. And now it has reached the Upper West Side. And I'm sure we're not alone in having that that new mandate. It started in September.
I mean, I think that is our greatest hope, is really sort of the power of the city-state this juncture, and individual, you know, locales, you know, pushing for those kinds of changes. So.
Yes, absolutely. And what do you think, as my last question, how ready do you think the American population is on the whole to receive this kind of information and act on it? Do you feel like we've reached a place where, you know, people are sufficiently aware of the impacts of food waste, that they're going to feel the way you did and the way I do about recycling, about composting? Because I got religion about composting after, I mean, we did it as a child when I grew up. That's how we always composted. But I grew up in the country, you know, so, you know, for 5 or 6 years, I was like, oh, I can't stand it. I don't want to have those food scraps on my counter. You know, it's like, blah, blah, blah. And now I'm just like, I have to do it. You know, my compost bin is chock-a-block, let me tell you. I actually have to buy a new one. And I'm going to get one of those tumbler ones, actually. This is from my house in Rhode Island.
When people see, you know, see the film and they hear that one statistic, which was really the big hammer on my head,
yeah.
which was my food that I'm throwing away is not decomposing. Organically, it is rotting in a landfill and creating 23% of the methane gas that's getting released.
Wow.
You know, greenhouse gas. That is an unbelievably eye-opening statistic.
Yes.
You know, and we interviewed, we did a couple of man on the street interviews where people were scratching their heads. Really? No, I thought that head of lettuce that I threw away just sort of decomposes in the dirt. No, it doesn't. It and the length of time at which it's decomposing in landfill, also an unbelievably eye-opening statistic. So I think our hope, and we feel very confident about it, is that the film is going to be a strong educational tool. There is a component of the film that, and part of the grant we got from Rockefeller Foundation was to create a curriculum, and we've partnered with James Beard Foundation to create a curriculum for culinary schools to re-educate, you know, new up-and-coming cooks and chefs on the idea of food waste. So that's a big component that we're working on as well. So I don't know. I feel people are ready, and they just need the
information. Right.
They need the information. Yep.
And then there's that basic statistic is that every household is throwing out somewhere between $1,500 and $2,000 worth of food a year. Like,
yes,
boom.
Exactly.
Boom.
Right? It's
you
can
go on vacation, man. Like, you can use that money to go on vacation. Like,
yes, you can. Buy some new clothes.
Right.
That's what you need.
Right. Lydia, thank you so much for joining me today.